Second narrative by Matthew Brough, lawyer. Chapter 1. I can throw some light on certain points which have remained in the dark. My narrative begins shortly after Lady Verinder's death, when I heard of Miss Verinder's proposed marriage. I was terribly disappointed when I heard that she was to marry a man I had always believed to be a smooth-tongued flatterer. I was certain of his financial motives, and felt it was my duty to warn Miss Rachel. But I did not want to worry her so soon after her mother's death. On the other hand, if I remained silent, she would go ahead with a marriage that would make her unhappy for life. I called at the hotel in London where Mrs. Ablewhite and Miss Rachel were staying. They were going to Brighton the next day. Unexpectedly, Mr. Godfrey could not accompany them, so I offered to. I was able to talk to Miss Rachel the next day. I recommended that she should tell Ablewhite in private that she had proof of his financial motives, and that therefore the marriage was out of the question. I told her to tell him that if he tried to oppose her, she would make her knowledge public. After I returned that evening, Ablewhite's father came to my office. He told me that his son had been dismissed by Miss Rachel and had accepted it. This confirmed my theory that Godfrey needed a large sum of money, and needed it quickly. Why else would he give up so easily a lifetime of luxury? His father wanted to know whether I had an explanation for Miss Verinder's extraordinary behaviour. Obviously, as her lawyer, I didn't have one. I was sure that Miss Verinder might find him difficult to cope with when he visited the next day. I thought it better if I was with her. The meeting has been described by Miss Clack and resulted in Miss Rachel coming to stay with my wife and me. A week after the end of her stay with us, my secretary informed me that a gentleman wanted to see me. There was a foreign name on the man's card. Below it was handwritten, "Recommended by Septimus Luker." He was extremely polite, well-mannered, and very smartly dressed in European clothes. The moment he entered my office, I knew he was one of the three Indians. I felt uneasy, knowing he would have murdered me if he thought I had the Moonstone. I asked what his business was. He unfolded a gold cloth and showed me a tiny box, beautifully decorated with jewels. "I have come, sir," he said, "to ask you to lend me some money. I can leave this as a guarantee." "Luca recommended me?" I asked. He nodded. "Yet he knows I'm a lawyer, not a moneylender like him." "He refused you?" He nodded. "And so do I," I said. He wrapped up the box and got up.
"Supposing, sir," he said,
"that you could have lent me money, how long would you have given me to pay it back?" "A year," I replied. "Is that the usual time in this country?" he asked. When I said it was, he smiled contentedly and bowed. I felt sure for some reason, as I watched him leave, that pawning the box was just an excuse to lead up to that very last question. Shortly afterwards, Luca came to see me. The substance of what that slippery old crook had to say is this. The Indian had visited him the day before, dressed in the same way. Luca recognized him as one of the Indians who had been begging at his house. Knowing that he must also be one of the men who had robbed him of his banker's receipt, Luca was terrified. The man showed him the box and asked for a loan. Luca refused, saying the best person to ask was a respectable lawyer. He recommended me. I asked him what the Indian had said before leaving. He had asked the same question and got the same answer. A year.